Welcome to Planet Poetry. I'm Robin Houghton.
And I'm Peter Kenny. And today we're getting out the microscope to take a closer look.
We'll be talking to Katrina Porteous about her collection Edge and what happens when physics and poetry collide.
And Robin also talks with Sarah Solway about the art of close observation and her book Digging Up Paradise.
Plus, we're getting very close up in the heat of a Greek afternoon.
Although, in reality, we'll be cringing on a freezing pub terrace in Lewis, but that's another story.
Now, Peter, how are you feeling today?
Well, weirdly, I'm feeling unnaturally grateful and cheerful because I'm thinking of all the people who've been listening to this podcast and giving us lovely comments.
Yeah, it's wonderful, isn't it?
So if you've been one of those wonderful people, thanks very much. It's really encouraging because I don't know if you can tell, but we've only just started in this game and we're making it all up as we go along.
And to know that people are actually listening to us is really heartening and also slightly surprising.
But we've got a mission for you. What you can do as a newly loyal listener is tell your mates about it. That would help us a lot because, well, you know, we've got this typical poetry budget.
Of zero.
Yeah, almost nothing. So what we're thinking is that you, our listener, is a kind of secret weapon. You've got the power to pass on the news about Planet Poetry.
Yes, and if you're enjoying it, please spread the word. We'd be ever so grateful.
And now, let's listen to Robin's interview with Katrina Porteous.
It's a great pleasure to be talking with Katrina Porteous today. Katrina has had three poetry collections published by Bloodaxe, the most recent of which is Edge, and this is the book we'll be discussing today. From the back of the book, I quote, "Scientists and engineers are the great explorers of our age. Poet Katrina Porteous translates to the non-scientist contemporary questions about the nature of physical reality and our understanding of it." So Katrina, the theme for this podcast episode is close up. And my understanding of quantum theory, such as it is, is that it's about uncovering and explaining the smallest units of matter that make up not just our world, but the universe. Am I close in that description?
Yes, well, I'm not a scientist. That's the first thing to say. I must point out I'm a poet, and this is a poet's view of science. But yes, quantum theory is the best description that we have of the nature of the particles that make up not just matter, but also the forces that they interact with that make the universe. If we're looking at these very abstract, very tiny quantities of matter and force, and the fascinating thing for me is that everything that we know about them, which is contained within the standard model of particle physics, doesn't mesh with the universe on a larger scale. All the rules which apply to the minute quantum world, completely different set of rules for the larger universe.
You sort of think, hang on a minute, is someone getting it wrong somewhere? I almost don't want to know that. It's just like, don't tell me that. You know, the world's going to fall apart.
Yes. Theoretical physics just raises endless questions.
I don't know. Maybe a good way to get into this would be if you were to read a poem or two from the beginning of the book and maybe introduce them.
Yes, I'm happy to do that. There was a lot of publicity a few years ago about the Higgs boson when it was discovered. But really what's interesting is the Higgs mechanism itself, which is, it explains how a particular class of particles has the property of mass. And mass is really important in physics because it's what gives the universe its shape, if you like. When the universe was very, very new, immediately after the Big Bang, it was extremely hot and it immediately started to cool. And as it cooled, very shortly after the Big Bang, there was a moment of what's known as spontaneous symmetry breaking. And that was what brought mass into being. And that was the moment of the Higgs mechanism. So this is a poem which is talking about that. And it's called Quiet. Zero could bear its own company not a zeptosecond longer. Abrupt disjuncture. One moment, an undifferentiated plane. Heat, sheer as water. the next everywhere, glittering, crystalline. And Zero alone knows why this has happened, why it has smashed itself to see what lies inside the mirror. Tell it again. You might have known it would begin with violation. Inconceivably hot, cooled, unspeakably fast. Something froze out, fluency, locking to ice. Some spontaneous crack. Weak interactions making their fateful choice. And all because something is lurking in the background. Some old instigator sneaking among the maidens. This gaining mass by gobbling up that. The ancients were right. It is all coupling and disguises, feverishly swapping bodies when no one is looking.
It's fascinating. I think you've got this sense of violence. We're in a scene of, it's almost destruction and yet it's creation, isn't it? It would have been perhaps one way to go to pull in a lot of allusions to creation myths. You've taken quite a different route.
I started from trying to understand the physics. I wasn't thinking about ancient mythology at all. The whole effort of writing these poems was all about grappling with something I really didn't understand. I didn't do science at school. And all the description of the Big Bang and what happened immediately after it and the gradual unfolding of the shape of the universe, trying to find the language for all of that was the real struggle of writing these poems. So I think I drew on all kinds of different vocabularies and narratives to try to find a way of talking about it, and a way of talking about it that wasn't human. I very strongly didn't want it to be human.
You said in your introduction that this is a book with almost no people in it. And yet I did notice that we have a lot of personification. We have characters called Zero that you start to think of as people, or as having agency at least. Perhaps that was one of your strategies to make sense of it, both for yourself and for your readers.
The particular poem we're talking about at the moment is the first sequence in the book, which is called Field. And the book contains three sequences, and each of those sequences was written for performance. So they weren't written primarily for readers, they were written to be heard out loud together with Peter Zinoviev's music. What I was aware of was that there was twin language of physics, first of all mathematics, and then a scientific language, which had lots of what we might call jargon words in it, or certainly science words in it, words like, you know, quarks and bosons and fermions, and even things like matter and force. I really didn't want to use that language either, because I thought that would be quite off-putting. What did I have instead? All I had was metaphor.
Yeah.
So everything that I was doing was really, in some sense, an act of translation. Mm-hmm. And I think what was interesting for me about that was that science is supposed to be using language objectively. But as soon as you get away from mathematics, it's all about narrative in the end. The one thing that really struck me about this quantum physics was that you can see in the lines of the equations how they change. And it's almost like reading music. I mean, I don't read music either, but you can sort of hear it in your head when you look at it on the page. And the equations are like that. There's a real beauty to them. And you begin to get some sort of intuitive feeling that there is so much to the universe that is real, but we cannot perceive it with our senses.
You've pulled me in, I think. I need to know more. Perhaps you could read another poem.
Great. Well, like the first poem I read, this is about that instant after the Big Bang with the cooling that triggers this symmetry breaking, this spontaneous symmetry breaking, which is the Higgs mechanism. So this is called Higgs. At a stroke, everywhere is instantly indelibly local. When the numbers austere machinery shatters, the shimmering little ideas snap into the actual. Look, they are dancing together. Down the mirrored corridor, an echo of laughter. So space is a vacuum, and it contains a multiplicity of what are known as fields. And the Higgs field interacts with most classes of particles to give them mass, but there are exceptions. There are some classes of particles which don't get mass. And one of those is the photon, which is the particle that carries electromagnetism, which includes light, and the gluon, which is the strong force which holds everything together. So this poem refers to that. Quantum two. Emptiness. You are a paradox. You are not empty. You are full of numbers. Wherever you are, expect commerce. Matter travelling through you slows to do business. Emptiness, you are a marketplace. Matter, you are trade. Only the light escapes, free, gratis, and the thing that holds us together.
These poems were all written together to be in collaboration with a composer, weren't they?
Yes, this book, Edge, contains three sequences, and they are all meant to be performed, and they are all performed to Peter's music. Even though I believe that the poems stand on their own as poems, and that's why I've published them as a book, they are essentially meant to be heard, and indeed to be seen with visuals as well. They were all written for the Planetarium in Newcastle at Life Science Centre. They're immersive performance pieces, so to enjoy them fully, you should have the planetarium dome with the visuals and Peter's music, which is surround sound, so it's very immersive, and I'm performing the poetry at the same time. It's a very sort of loud, there are many different voices in it. There's chanting, there's shouting, there's whispering, there's a lot of dynamics in it. And when this is all compressed down into stereo, it's a very different experience. So you really have to have the performance, I'm afraid.
You've got to be there.
So that was another reason for doing the book. In a way, I wanted the text still to have a life. This is a real departure in my work, and I think for a lot of people it will seem like a rather strange one, because if I'm known for anything at all, it's for probably for writing landscape poems that are based in Northumberland. But the thing is, I think I've always thought of myself as writing, in the broader sense, ecological poetry, and I really felt very strongly that I wanted to write something that was still about nature, but about nature without people. By leaving people out, you can then see where we are as a species, where we belong in the universe, and how incredibly special it is that we're here at all. Our planet is tiny, we're so nothing at all, and yet we're also incredibly special. And to get that sort of sense of perspective and scale, I thought of that as being just a sort of continuation of my own writing about place. It's not really all that different. And where Peter comes into all of this, he's a really extraordinary figure, Peter Zinoviev. He's an inventor, he's a scientist. He stopped writing music for a while, but he came back to it in 2010. And that was really the starting place for me to be able to collaborate with him. I'd known him for decades before that. And we wrote our first piece, which was called Horse, and was a radio piece about the Uffington White Horse. So that was a landscape poem of the kind that I'm used to writing, but it was a poem with Peter's computer music. Writing these pieces for the Planetarium in Newcastle, the three pieces in this book, Edge, was a sort of continuation and expansion out from there.
Something you said in the introduction to the book is about how you looked at a lot of images, photos and images of planetary action in space. What is the word? Was looking at these images a big part of what inspired you and got you thinking?
Yes, it certainly was. There are some extraordinary space images now available, and the internet makes them, you know, immediately available to all of us. The NASA site, the Hubble Space Telescope, those extraordinary images which are looking so deeply into space. They're looking at very, very early in the evolution of the universe. Looking at those images was extremely inspiring. And then for the piece I wrote about the sun, there are solar telescopes which are up there in space beyond Earth's atmosphere, which are taking photographs. The Solar Dynamics Observatory takes photographs of the sun in 10 different wavelengths, you know, every few seconds. And these extraordinary images of things which we cannot see with our eyes, and yet which are real. And also these machines which can see these extraordinary particles, which are so tiny. They're like the most immense microscopes, these colliders. So the Large Hadron Collider in Switzerland, this underground machine, the largest machine which human beings have ever built to look at the smallest particles. And I just find these images and this idea of extending our senses so amazing and inspiring.
Yes, well, I'm not surprised. You make it sound that way. I love the idea of the largest machine we've ever made just to look at the tiniest thing. You know, it seems like a paradox, really, doesn't it?
It is a paradox, yes.
Speaking of the sun, would you perhaps read a poem from Sun, which is the second sequence in the book?
Yes, I shall read a poem from near the end of Sun called Window. And this is about exactly what we've been talking about. The sun is amazing, Robin. The sun is amazing. You know, we'd so take it for granted. We wouldn't be here at all if it wasn't for the light and the heat, the electromagnetic energy that's coming from the sun. And yet at the same time, it's not entirely benevolent. It's bombarding Earth with all these cosmic rays. And it's only because our Earth has a core of molten iron, and we therefore have a huge sort of magnetic field around the Earth, which can deflect a lot of this damaging stuff. So this is a poem which is really about that, and about just how extraordinary it is to be here at all. It's called Window. Something crept in through a window and set the factories to work processing their simple chemistry. Something squeezed in through a crack until what it made happen recognized it and responded. Something sneaked in with a message. Imagine hydrogen crushed to metal, iron maddened into gas, gas gone insane. A small ship, its hatches battened. Through the narrowest gap, something extends a tentative question.
I love Window. I think this one really spoke to me, and a particularly ending like that with the tentative question. I think I might ask you just to read one more poem. I'm thinking of Intertidal, which comes at the end in what you've called the coda after the three sequences. I sort of felt reading the book by that time I was really being pulled back down to earth, you know, the sea, the land, the weather, what we're actually living in. And that kind of made it all real again, almost like coming a full circle. That's how it felt to me as a reader.
It was coming back to a landscape which I've written about consistently for more than 30 years, because it's the rocks which I can see out of my window. I live right by the sea. I'm very, very lucky. And I've always been fascinated by them. They're about 280 million years old. They've been here for so long, and they've seen three mass extinctions in their time. And I think we're all becoming a little bit more aware now that we're probably living through another mass extinction at this very moment. And I think this matter of scale and where the human fits into the scale, both of life on Earth and the age of our planet, and then the age of the universe beyond that. That's where this poem Intertidal came from. I think it was revisiting this old landscape in the light of the poems in Edge. And I'd also like to say, just before I read it, that the effect of writing these poems on me has been very marked emotionally, I think. It took me imaginatively right off this planet and out into outer space. So it was emotionally very hard writing about those inhuman, difficult, cold places. And then writing Field was the sort of opposite of all of that, because there was something geometrically so beautiful about the constituent parts of the entire universe. I think between those two things, the sort of vast coldness of outer space and yet the intense beauty of the structure of the universe, somehow to me the human sits directly between those two things. And writing this poem Intertidal was somehow a meditation, I think, on all of that. So here it is, Intertidal. I walked out to the end of the broad rock at low spring tide. a prehistoric foreshore, empty pavement, jagged, violent brown stone broken apart under the sky's hammer, strange shrieks, wild shouts loosed from somewhere very far away, vast, wide, metallic, mineral. In every seam and channel, slippery, smelling briny with excitement, beards, groins, armpits, dripping pelts, the colours of old bronze, dried blood, new grass, carrageen, coralina, sea oak, sorac, unpicking the chemistry of air, salt water, sunlight. Before me, kelp beds, freshly exposed. Then the seas glitter, green algae gobbling the red gleam close to the surface, red algae eating the blue gloom in the deep water, the tawny, the ochre, leathery, rubbery, feathery, floating, provisional, shuffling their elements as far as light can penetrate until there is nothing here but process, and I have to turn back.
It's a fantastic way to end the collection, I think. I mean, just some of those, the languages, so the beards, groins, armpits, dripping pelts, and the carrageen, the coralina, and the sea oak. It's just, you can almost taste what it's like to be there. It's very sensuous, and I love the way you've come back to what we can see and touch and smell or taste after having gone for this long journey out to, as you say, the inhuman universe, as it were. So I think it's a marvelous way to finish a powerful collection, and I want to thank you because I've not come across your work before, and this was so interesting.
Thank you. It's lovely to have the opportunity to read some of them and to talk about them. These poems are a very different experience with Peter's music. I hope that they'll get people thinking about the place of the human in the universe and encourage people to find out more about the science, because it is absolutely wonderful. I hope it takes people back to the science.
Katrina, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
So that was a fascinating interview with Katrina. It was a bit of a head-stretching interview of all that stuff about quantum theory and all the jargon of science and mathematics. I thought it was quite interesting when you said it was a book with no people.
Book with no people, and yet she does personify all these abstract things, you know, not just things like the sun and the moon that you kind of, we're kind of in poetry, we're used to those being personified, but although she said she was keen to take it out of the realm of the human in a way.
Yeah, she said she didn't want it to be human, which I thought was, I mean, it's quite a bold thing to be doing in poetry, really, which is kind of such a human art in a way. I did like it. I was left with the feeling that some of the earlier kind of more abstract poems, if they were coupled with the music, I'd like to have experienced that, I think, because the music, I have worked with classical musicians in the past and put words to their music. And the beauty of that is that the music actually creates the emotional undertow, and the words kind of make more sense because they've already got that emotional charge with them.
I think that's absolutely right. And when you think about the music, the soundtrack to films or TV shows, if you took away the music, a lot of it would be completely flat. The dialogue and even the action, even the visual action, it relies on the music. So it becomes a whole package. And I think Katrina was quite firm about that, wasn't she? That these are meant to be performed. Although she still said, yes, but they are poems in their own right, which is why she brought them out as a book. I think they do work.
It made me think of crystals, you know, that sort of precision and clarity and sort of, it felt inorganic. And it was that last poem that she read, was it Intertidal?
Oh, yes.
You seem to really like that, and I really like that too. And that moved on to kind of organic imagery. There was all seaweedy bits and the rocks. And for me, I found that, you know, really easy to connect with, and actually brought that great cosmic scale down to something more tangible.
Yes. And Katrina did say, didn't she? She was out of her comfort zone doing this book. And yet, in a way, I think she pulled it back into nature. And in fact, it is nature. That's the link with the close-up theme.
Yeah.
She's looking very closely at what it is that we're made of.
Yeah. I mean, I love that idea of really writing about something that poets don't normally write about and straying into the territory of science. Fascinating stuff and really bold and really kind of experimental.
And great passion in the way she delivered the poems as well. And when she was talking about the whole subject matter, clearly she'd been completely gripped by it. Mm. And that's quite infectious.
Sarah Solway has written 6 books, 3 novels, a book of short stories, and 2 collections of poetry, including Digging Up Paradise, which we'll be talking about today. She's also a journalist and a former Canterbury Laureate. Sarah is a creative writing tutor and has a particular passion for writing for wellbeing, running groups in libraries, gardens, yurts, and corporate offices. So, Sarah,
you're... a lovely book, Digging Up Paradise. I mean, there's this wonderful mix. You basically go round a lot of gardens in Kent, famous and not so famous, and you introduce them. There are photographs and then a poem. It's just such a lovely mix. I sort of devoured it. You have the moments when you think, gosh, I just hadn't seen that garden that way before. I didn't know that bit of history. That reminded me of something I'd read recently on Maria Popova's Brain Pickings, where she mentioned a book by Alexandra Horowitz, who I hadn't come across before, but she has written these books about taking walks and observation, and she's written about dogs. And she says that walking and how when we go about our daily lives, so much of what happens is not remembered because we are concentrating on the task in hand. And she mentions about how when she started going up for walks around her block, when she took different people with her, she saw much different things. She saw so much more. Do you think that's the kind of thing? Is that a good thing for poets to somehow develop?
I love that. So like a library of people, when you want to know about something, you can take someone
possibly.
Out. That's really true. I've never forgotten going to an art gallery with my friend Dorothy, and she just, oh, but that's there because of this, and there's, you know, symbolism and everything. And it was like, oh, I saw paintings in a whole new way. And I think the same way, if you go for a walk with someone that knows about birds, someone that not just knows about trees, but knows about why that tree is here and, you know, where it came from. Yeah, I think that would be brilliant for poets. But I think during lockdown, I think a lot of noticing was going on. And I have this like wild red rambling rose over my back wall. And when I went out of the house one day, there was a guy standing there and he was just staring at it. He said, "Has it always been this colour?" And I was like, well, yes. But he's obviously been rushing to the train or, you know, something like that. So I think there was a lot of those moments that we all had that I think now will become part of our emotional history when we go on walks.
So there was this quote that I saw from George O'Keefe where she said something like, I have to say things in images, in art, in paintings, because I don't have the words to say those things. And I thought, gosh, that's interesting. Poets, we sort of feel we've got the words to say things that can't necessarily be said in art. I don't know. What did you think about that?
I loved it, actually. And what's bizarre is that I'm reading a book of her letters at the moment, George O'Keefe's letters.
Oh, are you?
Yeah. And there's this quote that she also had, which was, "Nobody sees the flower, really. It's so small, it takes time. Like to have a friend takes time." And I just adore that. So they kind of go...
That's a lovely quote.
Yeah, yeah. That I was thinking about the shape and the colour. And I think that where poetry does that is with metaphor, but also how a poem breathes, really. So a poem that is very enclosed without much space kind of rushes at you, you get the feeling that of a colour and a shape with that. But you also read Louise Gluck, who I'm really fond of, and Alice Oswald, you read their poems about flowers and you get to see the flower from by metaphor, but also using characterisation, I think.
Yes.
Sticks in your mind, totally.
I think that's absolutely true. I get something very different from looking at one of those George O'Keefe enormous, wonderful flowers than reading about such a flower. It just feels different. Maybe it's a different part of the brain. Mm. When you're teaching, do you have certain exercises that you love to run with that opens our eyes a bit more, training people to be more observant?
Yeah, in fact, I was talking about close observation in a class recently, And one student said, "You're always banging on about this." So I said, I talk interestingly and usefully about it. So, yeah, so it's something that I think is essential because it stops us writing in the abstract. Once we look at something, then that's when we're going to put the concrete details in. But also that's when we're going to put a bit of ourselves in because it's what we've noticed.
Yeah.
So some of the exercises that I will do, particularly this works very well if it's an early morning class, is to say, write down 10 things that you've noticed before you've come to class. And people are amazed at how much, A, they've noticed, but how much by the act of writing they remember that they've noticed. You know, so it's these things that would slip otherwise. Another thing that is like, I think, an amazing exercise is to get them to write 10 decisions they've made before they've come into the workshop room already that morning.
Oh, gosh.
And that's particularly in writing a well-being, that can be quite good when people feel they've got no kind of, you know, their decisions being made for them. They've suddenly realised they have made these 10 and they could do things a different way just to shake things up. There's an exercise that I also like, which I stole from Alicia Stubblesfield actually, and that's just observations daily, which I do very often. So one thing from the natural world you've observed, one thing from the built environment, one person, one habit, and one something from the news. So once you've done that, you're starting to get a picture, which is interesting, I think.
That's really interesting. And I like this idea of in the writing down, you also kind of consolidate the memory of it. And isn't that really what, you know, writing journals is about, I suppose, particularly if you reread them?
In February, I went to the Sahara Desert with a group of Scottish writers, including Linda Cracknell, who writes a lot about nature. She's a wonderful writer. She just writes a lot about walking and she does a lot for BBC. And we've been sending each other writing exercises which are about looking, but which are also about doing. And I think it's easy just to look and to make notes, but it's also actually, can you get actively involved? And so forcing each other to move out of our own comfort zones of exercises, which I think something as writers, we tend to have our toolbox. And that's been extraordinary.
Yes, that's interesting.
To write a poem with not pen and paper or computer, so but it has to be relevant. So like she wrote something using flower heads. And then I wrote something using odd bits of stick, you know, and it's just like being a kid again. But it also makes you involved in the process.
Gosh, yes.
I think more.
Yeah, so like writing in the sand on the beach or something. We'd like to hear you read something.
I'll read the Leeds Castle one. I'll just talk a little bit about it. So the Archibald Mackintosh guinea pigs, they were called. These were men who had been severely injured, facial injuries during the war, and he pioneered plastic surgery for them. And this was mainly at the hospital at East Grinstead. What I found out was that they had actually gone to recuperate at Leeds Castle. So this is called Narcissus. A work of art, the nurses call you. The stitching on your cheek as fine as tapestry. You'll have me hanging in the gloriette. You play the castle fool. But the rough stones under your fingers could be a self-portrait. Your hand a brush paused on your chin before you remember why the castle's windows are angled for defence. It's important to keep looking out. You head to the mirrored lake. Reflections are a maze you tiptoe through to reach the heart. Each glance becomes a needle until you're sewing a new picture.
That's lovely, thank you. And it's, and the gloriette, that's the folly, was it? A folly or a summer house?
The tower, yes. And when I found out about the guinea pigs, the Mackintoshes, using it, when I was walking around, I suddenly thought, there's no mirrors here. There was pictures, tapestries, etc. There are no mirrors. And then, of course, I realised, actually, you've got the moat, you've got a mirror everywhere. And that was fascinating. I think I got quite obsessed at that time about the gardens being used as a form of recuperation during the war.
Yeah.
So that, you know, people would go to these big houses, but actually they would be in the gardens. That's where they kind of did a lot of the recovery. I was actually in hospital in March with COVID. I had COVID pneumonia. So I was in for 6 days in Pembury. And a friend of mine wrote and said, well, it's been designed so every room has a tree. You can see a tree. But the room I was in, I couldn't see a tree. And then I was asking them, where's my tree? And the nurses were like, well, that's actually, you know, you're in the serious ward.
Oh, no trees.
No trees. And so I was so determined. I was standing on tiptoes and I could see a tree in the distance. And that was amazing. And I think there is this hunger for nature.
What brought me into poetry was that kind of raw but concentrated looking at nature. Is there still a place for that? Who, in your opinion, is practicing that well? And is there still a place for that if you are a new aspiring writer? Or do we all need to be, oh my God, we've got to be political now, we've got to talk about current themes? What's your thought on that?
And I think it goes back to, we shouldn't be making judgments about what people can write about.
No.
As long as you're not just writing the daffodil poem that you read at school, you know, if you're actually getting under, and I think this is where looking comes from, you're getting under as to why that means something to you and, you know, why it means something to where we're living, then you're going to kind of write a poem that is going to have resonance for other people as well, if it has to. You might just want to write a happy garden poem and that's all right for you. And going back to the pandemic and lockdown, is how important, I think people were surprised themselves with how important nature was to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, not just people lucky enough to have gardens, but parks and community gardens, people growing things. And it's interesting because it wasn't retreating. I was thinking about it, are people retreating it? But it was almost like they're exploring out from it.
You said at the beginning that nature is a good, that you can use nature as a metaphor, you can pull metaphors out of it. And if you had an example of a poem that perhaps you did it or someone else worked through a natural metaphor for something else entirely.
There is one that I heard just recently about black boys as trees. Oh my God, it's just amazing. Dennis Smith, because that is just the best example. One of the things that I wanted to mention, because I am obsessed with this at the moment, is, you know, we're talking about hospital and things. In the medical profession, metaphors are used to describe absolutely what's going on. So people will talk about like blood blooming or heart like a tree, you know, your breathing system and everything. But in I'm absolutely obsessed with plant names and local plant names. And, you know, that I like, say, with, you know, how they're almost metaphors in different parts of the country. And so there's one of the books that I kind of absolutely, Geoffrey Grigson, he wrote a lot about English plant names and things. And it's just like reading a dictionary. It's just beautiful to read through. So one of the ones that I was looking at recently was foxgloves.
Oh, yes.
You know, which is obviously you sort of think, oh, well, that's quite sweet, like little gloves that fox can wear. And actually they're found quite often around at foxes' earths. But obviously also they're poisonous, really. So it's deadly nightshade as well. So I did write a poem using both those foxgloves, but, you know, also with the background metaphor of the danger of that. So
yeah.
I could read that if you wanted.
Yes. Yes, be lovely. Thank you.
Social distance. We are talking about earthquakes when we pass the waterfall of foxgloves. I'm sure they weren't there before, you say, pausing to take a perfect Insta shot. As I imagine red shadows slinking by with freckle-splattered purple hands, I'm about to tell you how Shakespeare's father was a glove maker when you hand me your phone, and I take it without thinking. Your phone in my bare hands. Was touch once this easy? I watch your face catch my expression. Our weekly walks meander on paths around every topic, with shortcuts to those things we don't share with others. How many times has this very phone spilt out its secrets to me, but still you lean across our safe distance to snatch it back. You even pretend not to see the care I take to wipe my fingers. The foxgloves waving at us like tiny megaphones as we walk on.
So, Sarah, you've got a new pamphlet coming out with the lovely Maria Isakova-Bennett at Coast to Coast to Coast. Tell me about that.
It's a project that started last May when I was writing in residence at the Old Valley Spring Festival. And I started with haiku and then I called them short poems, for every day with a photograph attached. And that was actually an act of observation practice, I suppose. I wanted to put the two together. Yeah, it's going to come out next spring, I think, which I'm so happy. I think those books that she does are just works of art, actually. It's lovely.
They absolutely are, aren't they? They're all individually made, so looking forward to seeing that. Talking of which, the close observation exercise, I learnt recently that Emily Dickinson had created this beautiful herbarium before she started writing poetry, I understand, as a kind of basically set out to draw and label all the flora in her locale. An amazing thing to have created. And I saw some copies of it online. It's digitized at the Harvard Houghton Library. So anyone wants to look at that, they can look at it online. Did you know about this? Have you seen it? Or
yeah. It's amazing. It's, I mean, obviously I haven't seen it. Just seen it online, but it's just wonderful. I did a course, actually, online botany course this year with the Edinburgh Botanic Gardens, which was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And that was, again, about looking, but you had to draw the little plants and the seeds.
Yes.
And partly inspired by her, actually.
So what writers would you like to recommend for us?
So some of the ones that have inspired me the most are the wonderful Mark Doty.
Oh, yes.
His Still Life with Oysters and Lemon. I mean, I just find that extraordinary book. There's a book by the American poet Stanley Kunitz, The Wild Braid, which is a diary with poems of his in his garden. But there's a writer called Denton Walsh, who is the reason why I'm living here, actually. He had a very bad car accident when he was a student at Camberwell Arts College when he was 19, which left him unable to do the things he was doing before. He'd been a big cyclist and everything before. So he will write 4 pages about a blue plate that you just cannot stop reading. This is absolutely extraordinary. So I think sometimes there's the act of observation going, it's about going internally, being silent a little bit.
Yes.
And listening, which is also what I think we need to do when we're writing poetry as well.
Thank you, Sarah.
So a nice chat with Sarah Solway there. I liked this idea of really paying close attention to things as a writer. What was that she was saying about what she's asking her students to do about noticing things on the way to the class?
Yes, it was, you know, like write down one person that you noticed or one physical place, one man-made thing that you noticed, those sorts of exercises to kind of just get your mind in that mood of thinking closely about close detail, isn't it?
Yeah, like that idea about the notebook being the writer's secret weapon or whatever. There's sort of that tiny kind of close-up detail, like in her poem about foxgloves, the passing of a, you know, this potentially lethal phone between two people. It's little touches like that that kind of root it, aren't they? I like what she was saying about loving plant names. I'm trying to think of my favourite plant name. I don't know if I have one.
Cotoneaster, there are some strange ones, aren't there?
Well, I go out into my back garden and say, "What's that, Lorraine?" to my wife, and she tells me, and I say, "Oh yes."
Oh, she's good on that.
Yeah, she is. I could never seem to retain them.
I have to have some kind of mnemonic. We have a tree in the back garden, and I have to think of biscuit. It's actually hibiscus, so that's the way I remember.
The biscuit tree.
A biscuit tree. That's silly. So that's completely off piece, really, isn't it? All those Georgia O'Keeffe paintings. Yes, that herbarium by Emily Dickinson. I've just seen some of those drawings online, and it is amazing. I should say we're in the terrace of a pub in Lewes, and so
what's it called again?
The Rights of Man.
The Rights of Man. This is the last day of pubs being open in November in England.
Yes, we're recording this, and we're in Lewes, which is the heart of Bonfire, but Bonfire isn't taking place this year. But today would have been the day before Bonfire, which would be a big day of gathering, shall we say, in the pubs.
Yeah.
So it's mysteriously quiet in Lewes.
We were talking earlier about people possibly still having their personal explosions rather than the enormous persuasions. explosions. Persuasions?
As in actual explosions. Yeah. You mean like in ye old days of dodgy fireworks in the back garden?
Yeah. People chucking squibs.
We had some really dodgy, you know, you'd light one of those rockets in a milk bottle and then it wouldn't go off, so then you rush out and find out why it hadn't gone off. All the things you're not supposed to do.
They were so crap, weren't they? Those little Catherine wheels that you'd...
Catherine wheels.
Stuff like that.
But it's not quite the scale of fireworks normally in Lewis, where, you know, one rocket is the size of a table for six for dinner, really. That's
I get the party going.
Anyway, there won't be any of that tomorrow, apparently.
Yeah, none of that. We'll have no fireworks here. We've got to that time of the show when we start talking about what we're reading. Ask me what I've been reading, Robin.
Okay. Peter, what have you been reading?
I've been reading a book called The Scattered Papers of Penelope by a Greek poet called Katerina Engelaki Rouk. I hope I am pronouncing that roughly correctly. She's somebody whose name I've known for a long time. I had this friend who sadly died in the 90s that knew her. His name is Timothy Gallagher, and he wrote dramatic monologues mainly, but a very little bit of poetry. He knew her and was very influenced by her. So I'd not really read any of her work until I bought this collection. I've only really started reading it properly in the last couple of months. And it's that strange sensation of reading a couple of poems that actually influenced works by my friend that I knew later. So it almost feels like a weird sort of family thing. It's like, oh God, yeah, Tim got that from Katerina, and it's almost kind of spooky. You know, it's like meeting somebody. You're meeting a mutual acquaintance through their poetry. And because this friend of mine, Tim, was a real Hellenophile, loved Greece because he'd lived there for a while, which is where he knew Katerina. And I started going to Greece a lot in the early 90s and have been, you know, dozens of times since, and have fallen in love with Greek poetry generally. And there's a wonderful 20th century tradition of poetry in Greek, which is a bit of an obsession with mine. I won't go on about it too much, but there's a Constantine Cavafy, for example, and George Seferis and Odysseus Elitis are the big three in the 20th century.
I think Cavafy is the only one I've heard of, I must admit.
Yeah, just astonishingly. There's something about the Greek language which is very concrete. It's no sort of accident that Plato and some of those early philosophers were Greek, and they still remain very easy to read because they're not particular. You can pick up a Plato book and actually understand it really easily.
Are you talking about in translation, or do you read the Greek?
No, I don't read the Greek, but yeah, I've tried to sort of learn the language a bit, but I've failed dismally. But
well, that's quite tricky. So you're forgiven.
Yeah. So anyway, this book, The Scattered Papers of Penelope, was published in 2008 by Anvil, and it's just a great selection of this Katerina Engelaki Rouk's poems. And it's taken me ages to read through them because, not because they're hard, but because I just love them so much. You know, I find that with books I really like. You know, I just read a poem and then have to go away and think about it, or it inspires me to write something, or, you know, so it can take you ages to get through a book.
Mm.
Anyway, so what I'm going to do is read a poem called Heat. And
Heat?
Yeah. Because we're freezing here.
My feet are freezing, so give me a bit of heat.
So, we're still in the same pub garden. The sun is setting.
North facing.
all kinds of bird life in the cawing and looking vengefully at the setting sun. And there's
lovely
air conditioning. So I'm going to take you to sunny Greece.
Lovely.
I have to warn you, people in this have got their clothes off.
Uh-oh.
Right. Heat. In the heat of Greece, our sternums pressed together, spurted water. I drank your sweat along with your kisses, your sigh in the shade of the shutters. There, as the violent afternoon came on, you two were ablaze with your tangled hair, your divine lashes, your laughter refracted through the salty prisms of passion. In the sizzling heat, in the total stillness, the only shadow above us, black as destiny, the outline of our existence. an equation of insects. August festered like an open sore, while relentless cicadas echoed the poet's closing lines, not a breath of air. The pedantic fly that defiles everything sits on your cock, drinking your sap. The watermelon man passes with his megaphone. The afternoon falls at my feet like a severed head. That was translated by the poet and Jackie Wilcox. So it's a bit kind of, yeah.
I like that, yeah, but that's...
The sort of passion in a, you can just imagine that sort of sweltering Greek workroom. And the sort of passion of two people, and how once it's over, you know, the tiny detail of, you know, a fly landing somewhere. Yes. and then suddenly everything's over. The afternoon falls at my feet like a severed head. So yeah, I mean, that's a bit of a raunchy one in here, but there's some amazing poems.
Now you're
going
to give our podcast an R rating for that reason, I expect.
We'll sneak it under.
It's I'm really curious about her now, though. Because
she actually died this year, I think, maybe in March. I love 20th century Greek poetry. It's just knockout. Yeah.